One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
Hello, this is Candace.
And this is Elena.
And this is Cousins on Crime. Elena, I've missed you.
Oh, I've missed you. We've had to push some days around.
I know. We usually record on Mondays, but I've had my head in a hole the past week. Because the case I have for you today is a really tough one. It's, every murder case is tragic, but this one hurts a lot, and it has made its way under my skin. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Trigger warning for you. It involves a pregnant victim and two small victims, two young children.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. This case was suggested to us by one of our listeners, our aunt.
Hi, Auntie.
Aunt Joanna. She was like, hey, put this on your list. And as I usually do, I put it on my list when people write me and suggest a case. And I hadn't heard of this one, actually. So I did some preliminary research and I was like, oh my gosh, what is going on here? Wait, what is going on?
So you had to find out.
Yeah. I was like, I just couldn't let it go. It just grabbed a hold of me, as they say down south. This case has actually been highly publicized over the past 30 plus years, which usually would deter me from doing a really popular case. But the more I looked into this case, the more, like I said, I just could not let it go. So I'm going to go ahead and tell this story. And all my sources are in the show notes, but one resource in particular that I used was a website that was put together by the family of the victims. And it's got official case documents, trial transcripts, biographies,
interesting
chronology, even crime scene and autopsy photos, which I couldn't bring myself to look at. I usually try and look at those things just to get better details or a better feel for the crime scene and the facts of the case, but I just couldn't. Couldn't look at the babies. So I encourage you to check this website out for yourself if you don't get enough here. It'll be linked, like I said, in the show notes. And Lena, if I'm ever murdered, I would hope that you would put together a website like this.
Absolutely. I will. But you know what? You're not going to be murdered.
Well,
you're not.
I hope not. I've got stuff to
do.
You
do. And I pray for you every day.
Oh,
so
thanks. Back at
God's
you, babe.
God's got you, girl.
Thank you. And as always, just another tidbit. If I did happen to be murdered, make sure Keith Morrison covers my story on Dateline. Okay.
Okay, I'll write that in my notes so I don't forget.
Okay, so let's talk about one of the victims, Colette Catherine Stevenson. She was born May 10th, 1943, in Manhattan, New York. So fancy.
Yes.
When Colette was 10... her father completed suicide. So just as a young child, she went through something quite traumatic. Her mother soon remarried a man named Freddie Kassab, and he became a loving father to Colette. So he was her father for the rest of her life. When she hit seventh grade, she began seeing a guy named Jeffrey McDonald. Now, Jeffrey McDonald was a catch. He was voted most popular, most likely to succeed in high school, and he played football and went to Princeton on a scholarship. Just very successful, very driven and motivated. They dated on and off for quite a while, but became more serious around, you know, college age.
Oh, okay.
In fact, they were actually off when Colette learned she was pregnant with Jeffrey's child. And he was dating another woman at the time. So he did the right thing, as they did back then, and he married Colette. So he said, hey, Brenda, or whoever he was dating. I don't know what her name was. He was like, gotta go, actually. So Colette and Jeffrey were married on September 13th of 1963, just before my mother was born, in New York, New York. And they welcomed their daughter, Kimberly Catherine McDonald, in April of that following year. So the young family moved to Chicago in 1964 when Jeffrey was accepted to Northwestern University School of Medicine. So he's gone to Princeton. Now he's going to medical school at Northwestern. He obviously was very smart. And life was good. Like, yeah. In 1967, they welcomed another daughter into their little family, and her name was Kristen Jean McDonald. They called her Christy. And the next year, in 1968, Jeffrey graduated from Northwestern and began his residency back home in New York City at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. And then shortly thereafter, he actually joined the military. So not only very
interesting.
Yeah. So he didn't have to join the military. I mean, you think about people who are successful in the private sector or in civilian life, as you would say, and then they go and join the military. Like, they just want to serve their country with their skills. So quite respectable.
It's very ambitious.
Mm-hmm. So he joined the army. He went to San Antonio, Texas for an orientation period. That was his first assignment at Fort Sam Houston Army Medical School. And then his second assignment was at Fort Benning in Georgia. So he's kind of hopping around to these different assignments, doing trainings and such. Finally, he lands as a captain in Fort Bragg. So he was stationed there in North Carolina, and he was given housing at 544 Castle Drive in the Army Barracks. Now, in reports, they refer to their place of residence as a house. Some reports said it was an apartment, but it really was more of a duplex, like a semi-detached house. And that's kind of important to know, because when you think of an apartment, you think of people either below or above you. And then when you think about the crime happening, you're like, well, there's like just a ton more witnesses than if it was a house.
Exactly.
So just want to clarify that. He was assigned to the Green Berets, and he worked as a surgeon for the U.S. Army Special Forces Unit. But a few months later, that unit actually disbanded, and he got moved to be a preventative medical officer, where he worked in more of like a supervisory role. Less hands-on. Oh, okay. He wasn't doing surgeries like he was before, and he was doing more like paperwork, reports, like more of admin stuff. And if you think they were happy before, you know, everything was going great for them, they were exceedingly happy now, especially Colette. I mean, they were comfortable financially. They had both worked so hard, you know, in keeping their nose to the grindstone. He was in school.
Building a life together.
Yeah, exactly. And finally, he's in the career he's supposed to be in. Everything was coming together. Jeffrey had a good schedule at the hospital. He was generally able to be home nights and weekends with his family. And by this point, I mean, he was a family man. So he was with his daughter, Kimberly, who was 5 going on 6, and Kristen, who was 2 about to turn 3. Their birthdays were just right around the corner. So they had a busy, bustling household. They were, you know, very lively, lots of life and conversation. And they were even more overjoyed because Colette was 5 months pregnant with their first son. Oh. Mm-hmm. I saw reports saying that she was 4 months pregnant. Some reports said 6 months. So let's just say 5 months. Either way, that little boy had a heartbeat.
Go in the middle. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh.
So friends described the couple at this time as very loving. Colette was devoted and doting on Jeffrey and the girls, and Jeffrey was a kind, generous man who loved his wife and children, by all accounts. So the night of February 16th, 1970 was a pretty normal night for the McDonald family. Jeffrey had just pulled a 24-hour shift at the base hospital, and he had headed home to be with his family. He scooped up his 2 daughters, Kimberly and Kristen, and he took them to feed the pony that he got them for Christmas just months before. And then they headed home. How cute is that?
How fun. I know. I love
like,
that.
Every little girl's dream is to have a pony. I mean, like a pony for Christmas. Anyway, so they went to feed the pony. They came home, and Colette had made a really quick dinner. She was hurrying to get out the door because she was taking night classes at the college to further her education. She's just a modern woman, I tell you that, Colette.
Yeah.
Now, at some point in the night, Jeffrey said that he took a diet pill, which was at the time basically like speed. And he joked it later on in an interview, saying it obviously didn't work because he was snacking all night. But the reason he gave for taking the diet pill and why he felt like it was important to say was that he was heading up a weight loss group at work, and he wanted to support them by participating in the weight loss challenge. Okay. So they were all taking the diet pill, and he didn't need to lose weight. He was in good shape. I mean, he wasn't overweight or anything. So he was really just doing it to support the guys. So Colette, being the real modern woman she was, she headed off to class and left Jeffrey in charge of the girls. Modern dad, right?
Right.
He put his littlest daughter, Kristen, to bed around 7 p.m. And then he laid down in the living room floor to kind of unwind, decompress, you know, watch TV. And he ended up just falling asleep in the floor there. The reports don't really say what Kimberly, the older daughter, was doing at this time, but she was probably playing in her room or something. And the next thing he knows, his daughter Kimberly came to wake him up, saying her favorite show was on TV. So he looked at the clock and he was like, oh man, I've been asleep like on this floor for about an hour. So he put on her TV show. They watched it together. And when it was over, about 9 p.m., he put her to bed. Then about 40 minutes later, Colette arrived home. So the kids were in bed. And he and Colette sat in the living room. They watched a bit of TV. They had a drink. And you may be thinking, Colette was pregnant. But Jeffrey says they both had a drink. He said they had liqueur. Colette specifically had liqueur with creme de menthe. So I guess back then, you know, fetal alcohol syndrome was not a thing. I don't know. Maybe it was just
not too big on it. Yeah.
Then Colette went off to bed. I'm sure she was busted after her long day, you know, with the kids, then running off to school. That's a lot for anyone. And on top of that, she was pregnant. So she was like a nunite. So Jeffrey said she took an anti-nausea pill and may have taken a Benadryl to help her sleep, but he couldn't really be sure. And he was, he had basically talked about how she did that to help her sleep and it's safe during pregnancy and blah, blah, blah. So he wasn't sure if that.
But to mix the medication with alcohol, he should, I mean, shouldn't he know that you're not supposed to do that?
I mean, he should know that you shouldn't drink while you're pregnant, but
I mean,
I'm not sure the details around that, but this is his account of what happened that night.
Okay.
Well, Jeffrey didn't go to bed with Colette. He was like, you know what? I'm awake now. I had that little nap on the floor and, you know, sometimes
the diet pill
when
running through his system.
Exactly. You know, sometimes when you're so tired and then you have like a little nap and you're like, okay, I'm up. Well, he was wired. So he said, you know what? I'm just going to keep watching TV and try to get tired again. So he stayed in the living room. He finished watching the Johnny Carson show that he and Colette had been watching. Then he read some of his novel and he heard Kristen at one point crying. So he went in there, gave her a bottle of chocolate milk. Again, these are the details that are in the story that I think are weird. He gave her chocolate milk at a stupid hour. Like, I don't know. At this point, it was probably like
just
11 o'clock.
Just give her what she wants.
I know. So she settled back down. She went back to sleep. He finished his book around 2 a.m. He says he tidied up the kitchen, put dishes in the sink, and then he headed to bed. Well, when he gets into his bedroom, he saw that Kristen was in his spot, cuddling Colette. She was with her mama. She wanted to be close to her mama that night. And then when he got closer, he realized that Kristen had wet the bed. Poor thing just peed right in his spot. So he was like, well, okay. He didn't want to wake up Colette. He didn't want to clean the mess up by, you know, changing the sheets and everything. It was after 2 a.m. Okay. So he just carried Kristen back to her room, put her in bed, and he's like, I'll just go sleep on the couch. He goes, he fell asleep just as soon as his head hit that pillow on the couch.
Okay.
Well, he was awoken by screams. He heard Colette screaming, and in quick succession, he heard Kimberly screaming for him. So when he opened his eyes, he saw some people hovering over him. And he later described them in detail, and I'll get to that in a minute. But as he starts to get up to go, you know, see what's going on, he's hit over the head with what he believes at the time is a baseball bat. So he's hit over the head, then he's stabbed. And after struggling for a bit with this guy that's beating him over the head, he finally goes down and loses consciousness. There were two steps that went from the living room up into the hallway. And so it was about there that he lost consciousness and fell to the ground. But he
my goodness.
Yeah, he came to. He's not sure how long he was out, but he didn't see the intruders anymore. He said there were about four people there. He crawled down the hallway to check on his family and found Colette laying on the floor of the bedroom with a knife sticking out of her chest.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah. Jeffrey said he saw the word pig written in blood on their headboard. Does this sound familiar to you? The Charles Manson murders?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking right now.
So he said he took the knife out of Colette's chest. I don't know why he did this. He was a physician, so he knew that removing a knife is probably does more harm than good.
Damaging.
Yeah. So, but if I was in that situation, would I want to see Daniel? If I knew he was dead, would I want to leave a knife in his chest? Like, that's just not an image I would probably want. I don't know. I can't say what I would have done in that situation. But he says he took the knife out of her chest And he covered her breasts because they were partially exposed. He covered her up with his pajama top.
Oh.
Then he went to check on his girls. He found them both in their rooms, bloody, and he called the police. Military police officer Ken Micah was one of the first to arrive at the scene. He found Jeffrey laying on the floor next to Colette with his arm around her.
Bless. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. He approached and he could see that Jeffrey was still breathing. So he kind of leaned down and said, "Who did this?" He didn't at the time know the extent of Jeffrey's injuries. He just is trying to get some information before, you know, something happens and he can't get the information. So he leans down and said, "Who did this?" And Jeffrey kept saying, "Four of them, four of them." She kept saying, "Acid is groovy, kill the pigs." And he's like, "What? Okay." Jeffrey later described in detail that there were three men and a woman at his home that night.
Okay.
There were two white men. One was black. One of the white men was wearing a cross necklace. The other had a really pockmarked face.
Oh.
And the black guy was in an army fatigue jacket with E6 stripes on the sleeves, which is a rank of staff sergeant. And he's describing this woman in particular, Caucasian, long blonde hair, could have been a wig, he said. She was wearing a floppy hat, knee-high boots. And Officer Micah is listening to this going, okay.
A floppy hat. Yeah. Who's going to take a floppy hat to a murder?
Well, right. That's what I'm thinking, too. So Officer Micah was like, I remember seeing a woman that looked like that on my way here. So that's an interesting detail.
Oh.
Now, Colette had been beaten over the head with some sort of club, and she had 16 knife wounds to her chest and neck.
16.
Yeah. And she had 21 stab wounds that were later determined to be from an ice pick in her chest.
Oh, my Lord.
And the ME said they were driven into the hilt. So.
Wow.
All the way. Both of her arms were broken from putting up her arms to defend herself.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord.
So she was savagely beaten and brutally murdered. Her official cause of death was exsanguination, or bleeding to death from her stab wounds. Now, this is really rough, guys. Skip ahead if you don't want to hear about the children. I'll leave some details out, but you gotta know some of this stuff just because it's important to the case.
Okay, right.
Kimberly had also been beaten in the head. She was the 5-year-old. She had at least 6 blows to her head, and one of the blows had shattered her skull.
Oh, my Lord.
Her head was crushed. I'll leave out some of the things that I read about that. She suffered a brutal beating. She was also stabbed in the neck. The ME couldn't really count them precisely because, well, she's 5 years old and her neck is really small. So some of those wounds were overlapping each other. But he thinks she was stabbed about 8 to 10 times in the neck. Her cause of death was multiple cranial fractures, a cerebral contusion, and lacerations of the pharyngeal and laryngeal areas. So a combination of the beating and the stabbings.
Mm-hmm.
Her baby sister, Kristen, had 12 stab wounds to the back, 4 in the chest, and 1 in the neck from a knife. And if you think that's too much, she was stabbed 15 more times with the ice pick in her chest.
Oh my.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, these babies can't even defend themselves.
Yeah. Just totally brutal. Kristen died from multiple stab wounds, which caused her basically to bleed to death as well. So later in the morning, a detective with the Fayetteville Police Department, Prince Beasley, no relation to Pam Beasley from The Office. I had to throw in some humor just to kind of break it up a little bit, because I'm starting to feel
Thank
like
you for that.
I need a cigarette. So Detective Beasley got wind of the description of the woman in particular that was described by Jeffrey, and he knew somebody like that. Her name was Helena Stokely. She was one of his drug informants. So he's like, I know who that is. I know who he's describing. And he had just seen her that night of the 16th. He was parked outside the Village Shop, which is like a shopping center in Fayetteville. He was monitoring the major drug hangouts. One of those places in particular happened to be a Dunkin' Donuts, which if I'm a drug dealer, I'm not going to do business at a donut shop.
At a donut shop.
I mean, you're just asking to run into police. Anyway, now one agent that arrived that night was with the CID, which is the Army's Criminal Investigation Division. His name was William Ivory. He was like, I don't believe Jeff's story. He started to, from the get-go, turn up his
question
eyebrows. He didn't believe him when he arrived on scene that morning, and he began further distrusting his story the more and more that evidence was collected. Now, the only things that were disturbed in their small home was a turned over plant in the living room. The coffee table was laying on its side. Other than that, nothing else seemed too out of place. There was a pair of undisturbed glasses on the buffet in the dining area. There was like some greeting cards, like a Valentine's Day card, you know, undisturbed, just sitting there.
Okay.
He just felt like there wasn't a bunch of people in there wreaking havoc,
right,
you know, brutally murdering a family that night. So he's like, this doesn't feel right.
Right. Why were those three brutally stabbed and beaten and he has two injuries?
Good question. Now here's some more evidence they had against Jeffrey. They found some tips of surgical gloves beneath the headboard in his room. So they're like,
okay,
what is this all about?
Mm-hmm.
They later matched those tips of surgical glove to a pack of gloves that was found underneath the kitchen sink. Same kind, obviously came from the home. Additionally, they found drops of the same type as Jeffrey's blood. Remember, DNA testing was not a thing back in the 70s, so all they had was the blood typing. Well, they found his type of blood in the kitchen on the floor. Out back, they found the murder weapons, an ice pick, a kitchen knife, and a long piece of wood that was covered in blood. Now, they tied all of these items to the McDonald household, and that long piece of wood was actually like a scrap piece of wood that had been used while they were doing a little bit of light renovations in the home.
Oh.
Yeah. So, remember that knife that was in Colette's chest?
Her chest.
Mm-hmm. Well, that also came from the home. And they did some type of forensic testing. I don't know what they did. Couldn't find the information. But they basically said, well, that knife wasn't used on Colette. It was bent. So they, for some reason, think that it wasn't used on her. I don't know what they're basing that on. That's part of their evidence against him. They also found fibers from Jeffrey's pajamas under Colette's body, under Kimberly's sheets.
Mm-hmm.
And two more of these fibers were found in Kristen's room. One was actually under one of her fingernails. So there was a ton of blood in all of the bedrooms and hardly any in the living room, including Jeffrey's footprint in blood in Kristen's room and a speck of her blood on his glasses that were found in the living room that were undisturbed.
Oh.
So they're starting to look at all this stuff and it's all coming together, like not looking good for him.
Right.
Perhaps one of the most damning facts about the case, and you alluded to this just a second ago, was that his wife and two daughters were brutally murdered and he was only roughed up a bit.
Hmm.
here, let me just tell you what his injuries were, according to Dr. Russell Fisher's official report. He had a stab wound of the right anterior chest, estimated to measure 1.2 to 1.5 centimeters in length, which penetrated into his right pleural cavity and caused subsequent partial collapse of the lung. 2, he had a superficial puncture to his left arm. 3, he had a superficial laceration of the upper abdomen wall, penetrating into the underlying muscle at one end of the wound. So stabbed and then pulled out, but like kind of swiped across, if that makes sense. 4.
Interesting.
He had 4 tiny abrasions on his skin in his left upper pectoral area. And 5, he had a slight abraded contused area in the left forehead. He had a bump there, but the skin wasn't broken. So it was like he was hit in the head with something flat, maybe, that didn't break the skin, which is consistent with the piece of wood that he claims to have been hit with. Okay. Now, the CID, again, that's the Army's, basically their investigative division, they started putting together a theory. Okay. They used blood typing to put together a scenario of what they think might have happened that night by tracing the blood movements throughout the house. Now, they theorized, and this is kind of funny to me, they theorized that a fight started in the master bedroom when Jeffrey's masculinity was insulted and Colette hit him with a hairbrush. Now, I could not find any details as to
why they thought that
they came to this conclusion. Like, okay, I don't know where you got that, but okay. Then Jeffrey retaliated and picked up the closest thing he could find, which was the piece of wood, and went ham on her. Now, they say, yeah, he got hit first with the hairbrush. That's what the bump on his head is from.
Okay.
Okay, I don't know where they're getting that. But again, this is what they theorize.
Because it's a flat surface.
I guess. Now, they say Kimberly was possibly hit accidentally because her brain serum was found in the doorway of the master bedroom. So they think Kimberly was still in the bed, like sleeping there when they got into a fight.
Oh.
And then he swung and hit Colette and maybe accidentally hit Kimberly. So then he's just like, well,
interesting.
I've got to kill her now. So he kills her. And then he's like, well, now I've got to kill the other daughter. So he goes and kills her. And then Colette wasn't dead yet. This is, again, this is their theory.
All theory.
Colette wasn't dead, so she stumbled into Kristen's room and tried to save her, but he finished her off there, along with Kristen. So Jeffrey wrapped up Colette's body in a sheet and carried her back to the master bedroom.
Hmm.
They say he then began covering up the crime. He took all these ideas from this article on the Manson murders that was in a copy of Esquire magazine, which was located in the living room. So he's obviously just sitting there, you know, trying to figure out how to cover up these murders by pinning it on something else. So he stabs himself with a scalpel. He got gloves, wrote pig and blood on the headboard. He's trying to, you know, throw everyone off. He threw away the evidence in the trash can that they didn't even collect. So who knows if that's true. It's just a theory because they didn't collect it. Nearly 3 months after the murders, there was an Article 32 hearing. Jeffrey was brought in on charges for 3 counts of murder. With the Army. So they had a hearing, which is kind of like a grand jury in Army proceedings. The defense called a psychiatrist who had evaluated Jeffrey and concluded that he did have some, I don't know why this is relevant, but homosexual conflicts and narcissism that were present, but he was fairly certain he didn't kill his family. I think homosexual conflicts was mentioned because of the fact that they were trying to say that him and Colette had a fight, probably about something
there was
like this.
Problems in their marriage.
Exactly. They also called a character witness, which included his father-in-law, Colette's stepfather, Freddie Kassab. He was quoted as saying, "If I ever have another daughter, I'd still want the same son-in-law."
Oh, wow.
So he was very much in support of his son-in-law. Also, a delivery man named William Posey came to Jeffrey's attorney saying that he knew a woman named Helen that fit the description of the woman that was suspected to be there that night. You know, the woman mm-hmm. with the floppy hat and all that. Well, he was talking about Helena Stokely, but he knew her as Helen. Anyway, he said that he'd always seen her in wigs and floppy hats, but after the night of the murders, she didn't wear any of that stuff anymore. Helena also told William Posey that the police were on her tail about these murders, but she was so high she couldn't remember if she was there or not. So with the victim's family supporting Jeffrey, the lack of motive for the charges, the colonel presiding over the hearing basically said, look, the charges against Dr. McDonald are unfounded. There is no evidence, there is no motive to suggest that he would have done this. And the civilian authorities really need to look into this Helena Stokely woman, because the more I'm hearing about this, the more it's sounding like it could be true. So at this time, the hearing was concluded and the military court wasn't going to pursue charges. Wow. They said, look, he's not guilty.
Yeah. I mean, you've got to have to send a person to prison mm-hmm. for, you know, you've got to be certain. And that's
exactly.
Didn't seem like they had all that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jeffrey McDonald and Freddie Kassab were hitting the pavement. They were writing every congressman they could think of. They were criticizing the Army's investigation, but also they wanted the case resolved. So they were saying, look, this was not properly investigated and we need a do-over. They got the support of Congressman Lowenstein, actually. And Jeffrey and Mr. Lowenstein held a press conference to air their grievances with the investigation publicly. They were like, hey, look, the Army's conduct here was abysmal. You know, we need whoever's responsible to be punished. Let's reopen the investigation. Let's take another look. And there really was a lot wrong with the CID's investigation. You know, we talked about in the Blue Mound case how sealing and securing the crime scene is really important. Now, at least 26 people trampled through that crime scene before it was secured.
And I'm sure they weren't being careful.
I'm sure not. One such person was an ambulance driver that stole the doctor's wallet. Classy.
Stole the wallet.
Yeah. He stole his wallet.
What?
Yeah. They lost samples from the crime scene. They lost some of the fibers that were collected. They lost that particular blue fiber that was found underneath Kristen's fingernail.
Wow.
There was a piece of skin tissue that was found under Colette's fingernails that was lost. Other potential critical evidence was lost. For example, 40 sets of fingerprints that were found at the scene were destroyed.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. So quite a lot of bungled behavior by the, I don't know. Shortly after this, Jeffrey went on to the Dick Cavett Show, which was like a late night talk show. And his behavior came off as a bit unsettling. Dick Cavett had this really sincere demeanor of condolence. He basically really tried to tiptoe around and say, you know, thank you for being here. This must be so hard for you. And Jeffrey was like grinning and making light of things when speaking about the night of the murders. And I watched the interview and I can totally see how it feels very inappropriate, you know, his behavior. Mm-hmm. But I mean, people grieve in different ways. And so maybe he was utilizing humor as a way to cope.
Or maybe he was taking some kind of medicine that just kind of helped him forget about things.
Exactly. And as my mom would say, no, I'm chill, you know?
Oh, Aunt Brenda. No, chill.
My mom doesn't need CBD because she's already chill, just so y'all know. but yeah, maybe he was taking something to take the little nervous edge off. Who knows? And a lot of people right. act kind of, you know, when they're nervous, they kind of act funny.
Well, yeah, you just act awkward and weird.
Exactly. I don't know. Who am I to say? Now, someone else thought this behavior was inappropriate, and that was Colette's family. They started to talk amongst themselves.
Even Kassab?
Yeah. Freddie Kassab felt his support for Jeffrey starting to wane. The victim's family, they weren't the only ones with raised eyebrows over this interview either. The CID was also tilting their head. Now, they saw this interview, and you got to remember, they already had it out for Jeffrey. They were just looking for a reason to take him down. They did not agree with how the Article 32 hearing went. They were like, no, there's more to this. Now, the CID at this moment, they were like, this is our moment to get Colette's family on our side. Like, he's hitting the, you know, interview streams. He's talking to the media. What is he doing?
Right.
And remember, they had developed that theory of Dr. McDonald killing his whole family. And then Freddie and Jeffrey were going around town campaigning against them, basically saying that their investigation was botched and whatever. So they were like, okay, let's get the family back on our side. And this is how we do it. So after the interview, they called up Freddie. They said, listen, I'm going to start going through the case files again, and you're going to be the first person to know when I find something concrete. That interview is weird. I don't trust him. And Freddie's coming around to their side. He starts ruminating over some things that Jeffrey was doing in the wake of his wife and two daughters' murders. They couldn't relate to how he was just trying to move on with his life. You know, we talked about people grieve in their own way. Well, he and the rest of his family felt like Jeffrey was just not grieving at all.
Gotcha.
Freddie learned that when Jeffrey was in the hospital recovering from his injuries right after the murders, his Green Beret buddies brought in a bottle of champagne and they had a drink together, which he thought was
what?
Very inappropriate and also like wine.
Absolutely.
I mean, the 70s, I don't know. Guys, I don't know. I don't know how to explain that. I don't even want to try. Then Jeffrey applied for honorable discharge shortly after the murders. He sold all his family's belongings in a yard sale, and he moved back to New York.
Oh, wow.
He began socializing with a countess. Also, while in New York, he was allegedly shopping his story around, trying to find someone to write a book on his story.
He's trying to make money off of all this.
Apparently. Then he moved to Long Beach, California, where he became director of emergency medicine at a local hospital there. Now, all this time since the Article 32 hearing, Freddie Kassab was hounding Jeffrey for a copy of the hearing transcripts because the Army wasn't telling Colette's family anything, and they weren't actually able to go to the hearing because it was closed to the military. So there were always like excuses that Jeffrey came up with as to why he couldn't get the transcripts and produce them. But eventually, after much time, he finally got the transcripts to Freddie Kassab and the family. Now, Freddie starts pouring through these transcripts, and he starts finding some untruths. For example, something Jeffrey said to him was really bothering him. Jeffrey had told him at one point that he saw blood bubbling from Kimberly's chest. It just like when he was describing that night to them.
Okay.
But in the transcripts, it says that the room was dark. And when the investigators got there, like all the lights were off except for the one in the master bedroom. And the other thing was that there was no injuries to Kimberly's chest, just to her neck.
Oh, okay.
So he couldn't have seen blood bubbling from her chest.
True.
So Freddy's suspicions started taking him down a rabbit hole. He went back to the crime scene. He was escorted by the CID there. It was still all boarded up, and they were basically the first people back in there since it had been all sealed up, besides Jeffrey McDonald, I'm sure. Now, he began to side with the CID, who suggested that there was no evidence that there was four people traipsing through that house that night. He said the cabinets were stocked with syringes and drugs. You have to remember, he's a doctor, so he probably has these supplies on hand. If there were drug addicts in there, wouldn't they have taken all of the needles? And
you've got a good point.
Who knows? Well, nothing else of value was taken either. So he's like, this isn't right. This is not right. So he starts recording his phone conversations with Jeffrey. In one of those phone calls, Jeffrey claimed that he and his Green Beret buddies tracked down one of the killers and killed them. So he's like, listen, listen, Freddy, I found one of them and I took care of him, if you know what I'm saying.
Okay.
And Freddy was like, okay, good, good, good. And, you know, he's just going along with this at this point. And Jeffrey later says that he was just saying that because he wanted the family to feel some sort of like closure or peace or whatever, because nobody else was seeming to care about the hippies that had broken into his home that night. So he knew that that wasn't really going anywhere. Nobody was looking into that. So Freddie also got wind of at least 15 different girlfriends that Jeffrey had had through his marriage to Colette.
Interesting.
Most of these extramarital relationships were developed when he was on his training missions, you know, bopping back and forth. That sounded bad. when he was in and out of town. Let me put it that way. And later, Jeffrey later claimed, well, these weren't actually like relationships. They were just one night stands, which, okay.
Even better.
When you're a wife, those details really don't matter. And when you're the family of the wife, it also doesn't matter. You are straying from your marriage, and that's what matters. I really don't care if you took her to dinner first. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
So Colette had known of these affairs, and she had actually told her sister-in-law that she was over it. You know, she'd even told her mother she wanted to come home and bring the kids, but her mother was like, you know what, just stay, just stick it out. And then a couple days later, she was murdered.
Oh, man.
Now, Colette's family said that the entries she made in her diary just before her murder was heartbreaking. She had talked about his infidelity and how much he had hurt her by his actions and some of the things that he said that hurt her. I wasn't able to find the actual journal entries. I guess those were not submitted into evidence, but this was just mentioned on the family's website. But all of that taken together, Jeffrey was finally arrested in January of 1975, and he was charged with 3 counts of first-degree murder, and he pled not guilty.
Not guilty.
Mm-hmm. And with that, I'm going to have to leave you there. We'll get into the trial and everything that happened after the trial in part 2, sadly.
Okay. So I'll wait.
but don't worry, because as we do with two-parters, you'll get the second part this week. So chillax.
Whoop, whoop.
Yeah. Take a diet pill, relax, have some creme de menthe, and fall asleep on your living room
floor. Watch some TV.
Exactly. Yeah. rest in peace, Colette and babies. So anyways, we will see you in a couple of days back here. Same time, same place. And thanks for listening.
Yeah, it was interesting, and I'm ready to hear more.
All right, guys. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.